and thanks for listening to Bear Soup with Ron Suresha. Bubbling up in the Bear Soup hot tub for this program, Bears on Film, from War Bear's contribution to the Tech Festival 09 catalog. Beard Lore, from Alan Peterkin's book 1,000 Beards. A reading from The Bear Clan, Mike Ramsey's chapter in The Bear Book. Shoutouts and the usual audio bear hilarity. I'm cooking up something mighty fine for all my brethren. It's a bubbling bowl of tasty, tangy holiday bear soup. Welcome once again to Bear Soup, news, schmooze, skews, and interviews from your forerunner, Ron Suresha, casting my pod through the mysterious tubes of the internets from southeastern coastal Connecticut, USA. Wishing you all a very happy, fun, and safe holiday season. You're listening to the Bear Soup Podcast number 61, streaming online at bearradio.net Mondays and Wednesdays, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific times. Bear Soup is also available through our free iTunes subscription and download service. Access the Bear Soup archives through the Bear Soup tab on ronsuresha.com or bearradio.net. Please remember to vote Bear Soup for Best Bear Podcast in the Complete Bears poll. Bear Soup is proudly sponsored by the BiblioBears at Bare Bones Books. While in Rome, my friend Warbear gave me a copy of the catalog booklet from Tech Festival 09, a progressive and queer film festival. And he wrote a section entitled Bears on Film, Roaring Screens, Love Nights, that features a movie which I'm not yet familiar with, Chueca Town. We propose once again the Bears on Film subsection. This year's theme is Roaring Screens, Love Nights, a videoscape that explores and deconstructs representations of masculinity in the LGBT community and beyond. The friendly bears are represented by a new cult figure of Spanish and worldwide cinematography, Juan Blan, director of Chueca Town. The film, which has received numerous awards and has been shown at LGBT and queer festivals around the world, besides being an exceptional movie, is an extremely profound and ironic reflection on how bears live in Chueca, Madrid's famous barrio. It is also a reflection on the process of gay gentrification taking place in contemporary metropoles. The plot centers on the meaning of this transformation, which creates a boundary in the West of gay codification and opens up new vital spaces, while at the same time flattening specific dimensions. The protagonist is a murderer in a breathtaking thriller between the bear bars, saunas, and desolate roads of Chueca, as the neighborhood changes its historical identity from a lumpen neighborhood inhabited by shoemakers, prostitutes, and drug addicts to a gay market. The story is part of a wider reflection on the meaning of gay couples, presented sometimes in a fluid, sometimes in a fragmented way, of fluctuating families where the female subject and maternity are viewed through a specifically Spanish gay lens and redefined according to new models. The film will be opened by Amit Is My Family, a tribute to Amit Yildiz by filmmaker Jonathan Robinson. The short is an emotional denunciation of the first gay honor killing of an activist bear involved in Turkish LGBTQ rights, which received much attention on the part of the Turkish press. Amit Yildiz's family is a different one that, rather than bullets, gives him the love of remembrance. This testimony will be narrated by Olivier Cherry, also known as Captain Bear, founder of the movement to remember Yildiz's death. Amit Yildiz Is My Family. ¶¶ Canadian writer Alan Peterkin has just issued an interesting book that he wrote with Nick Burns, The Bearded Gentleman, Style Guide to Shaving Face. I haven't gotten a copy of The Bearded Gentleman yet, but I'd like to read from his 1,000 Beards, A Cultural History of Facial Hair. In the 1950s, Dr. Charles Berg, a London-based psychoanalyst, wrote a book entitled The Unconscious Significance of Hair. His treatise is dead serious, though I challenge the contemporary reader to get through my overstated version with a straight face. In Berg's view, hair on the face and the head displace endopsychic tension from the equally furry but anxiety-provoking anus and genitals, where, as everyone knows, everything really happens in our psychological development. Historically, or at least in Victorian times, these bits were rarely displayed in public, though for some reason we cannot stop doing so in modern times. Berg reminds us that at puberty, facial hair sprouts at the same time as pubic sprigs, signifying full reproductive capability, burgeoning sexuality, and male potency. All of this would be completely natural and fine if it weren't for the many who harbor old, unresolved conflicts about their parents. In Freud's Oedipal theory, some of us still want to seduce mommy and kill daddy. Our emerging unruly beards become the equivalent of defiant erect penises, shamefully visible to all of society, which is why they must be cut down through the ritual act of shaving. We may have worked through a thing or two by attempting to identify with our fathers, whom we have hairily come to resemble, but we still need to psychically castrate ourselves daily to reduce this rivalrous tension. We find it simply unbearable to flaunt our unresolved Oedipal conflicts on our faces, so we ease the pain with a razor, remaking ourselves through foamy, and Berg would argue spermy, renunciation. In Freud's triumvirate model of the mind, all grooming can be seen as a form of endopsychic compromise between the scissors-yielding superego, the hair-sprouting id, and the embattled ego, which mediates between our inner worlds and societal expectations. Thus, shaving is both a symptom of and defense against id impulses toward our parents. The self would become a patricidal, incestuous, hairy phallus if left unchecked, so we kill it just to carry on. The narcissistic pleasure we appear to derive from trimming, plucking, cutting, dyeing, and perfuming our hair diverts libidinous energy to love of the self. We also manage to control our other main instinct, aggression, and death, by taking it out on our hair, which is dead in the first place. If we're lucky, and all these defenses work, we can be at peace with ourselves, and even come to identify with benevolent bearded figures like God or Santa Claus. Berg describes Father Christmas as a symbolic big cock, pulling little penis gifts for good children off the big phallus Christmas tree. We project bad hair days onto evil figures like Satan and werewolves and historical personages like Rasputin, men who let their ids and aggression run wild. Our ideas about hair can also be plagued by pre-Oedipal conflicts, infantile oral and anal strivings which weren't worked through early in life, or at least by age 4. Their hallmark is a sense of tremendous neediness, the Pac-Man hungry, rage, hoarding, and exhibitionism. If this is your hang-up, wild unkempt hair is like a dirty anus because hair now, of course, signifies fecal matter. We can, however, expiate anal rage by cutting and shaving and getting to the salon on a regular basis. But if we go overboard in our defenses, we develop obsessive symptoms, such as excessive grooming, or using too much perfume or makeup to hide our unbearable stench. According to classical theory, in this phase, we're much less worried about castration. Our mothers, or society's, disapproval at our soiling seems to rein in most of us. According to this theory, those of us who persist in wearing messy beards may be truly without psychological redemption. Unconscious explanations become even more complicated in cases of the sexual fetishization of hair, by no means a new phenomenon. Scalp hair is generally seen as a sign of genital vitality and appeals unabashedly to all of our five senses. If we haven't navigated the landmines of age-specific developmental conflict, our strivings to love, mate, and attach may become splintered and fragmented. We fall for a shoe or a wig rather than its wearer. We substitute fascination with what is called a partial object for the whole. We choose a symbol which somehow captures the person's erotic essence, a mustache, a plait of hair. Freud elaborated that men become fetishists because of an aversion to female genitalia. The woman's absence of a penis suggests that the Grim Reaper has already paid a visit, heightening the poor man's own castration anxiety. Much safer to fall for the locks on her head, as they are symbols of a restored phallus, geographically removed from the scarier bits. The early sexology literature recounts stories of men who sneaked up on girls and cut off snippets or pigtails, a symbolic rape, saving them for guilty onanistic pleasures. Though hair fetishes were seen as predominantly a heterosexual expression, Kraft Ebbing, in Aberrations of Sexual Life, wrote about a 20-year-old man with a mustache fetish. When the lad finally found the man of his dreams, the latter's stash proved to be fake, much to the chagrin of our subject. Havelock Ellis later disputed the sadistic or aggressive motives often ascribed to hair kinks, describing them as pure fetishes linked to symbolic displacement. That was from Alan Peterkin's book, 1,000 Beards.
The following is a reading of my favorite chapter in The Bear Book, edited by Les Wright, which came out in 1997. This chapter is entitled The Bear Clan, North American Totemic Mythology, Belief, and Legend by Mike Ramsey. In our modern society, it is often anthropomorphized, first being transformed into a lovable and cute character with the creation of the teddy bear. The bear has now come to symbolize something very different in the 20th century than it did throughout humankind's past. Today, the free-roaming and truly wild bear is all but a memory for most Americans, due largely to an effective extermination effort of the early pioneers in conjunction with today's constant pressure of expanding urbanism. The grizzly bear, Ursus arctos horribilis in Latin, now only resides within the most inhospitable mountainous regions of the continental United States. However, prior to the coming of the European to North America, the natives had a very different relationship with the bear. To them, it was one of the most powerful totemic spirits in all of nature. The unique similarity to man in many ways, coupled with the animal's strength and knowledge of the land, imparted with the Native Americans a great respect. In response to this, the native peoples of North America and other circumpolar tribes of the world evolved similar myths and legends regarding the bears present in their respective lands, while certainly differing in degree depending on the people and the aspect of the animal being celebrated. These legends are often told of a similar bear mother creation myth, bear wife story, and this intertwined relationship of human and animal has continued from the earliest cave dwellers through today in many of the Native American tribes still practicing their traditional religions. Today, the bear still holds a significant place in our culture. No longer seen strictly as a wild and fearsome animal, it has become the fuzzy childhood toy, the oafish cartoon character, and the leading symbol of forest fire prevention. Often given lovable names such as Yogi, Winnie, or Smokey, this bear character is stripped of those qualities that made it so important among the Native Americans. However, giving the bear human qualities and thereby relating to it more easily is perhaps not so very different from what the Native Americans did centuries prior. In both cases, humans are creating logical or spiritual ways to coexist with an animal easily able to kill with one swift blow of its paw. In order to represent such a presence, an elaborate and rich history of bear symbology has evolved. The symbolism illustrates the animal to others and connects oneself to the spirit of the bear, providing a constant reminder of the relationship between human and animal. Today it is manifested in the form of the stuffed animal, the photographic picture book, and the carved figurine on our shelves, while that of the Native American took the form of pictographs, twig figures, stone carvings, and bone weaponry. In an attempt to better relate to the bear, members of both past and present cultures have also projected ursine qualities onto themselves and others. For example, prior to the New Year celebration or before a hunt, Bear Clan members of the Yuchi tribe of the southeastern United States prayed and danced to the bear. Members of clans such as these often adorned themselves with bearskins, necklaces of claws, red face paint, and distinct hairstyles in order to physically become more bear-like. Today, rather than relating strictly to the animal, humans identify more with their own interpretation and characterization of the bear. It is perhaps not all that surprising that as the bear in our storybooks has come to more resemble humans, many men in our society were recognized as having bear-like qualities. A hirsute man of formidable size and strength is often given the nickname bear, for example. So, while the relationship of man and bear has persisted throughout human history, a distinct shift in the expression of that relationship has occurred over the last century. No longer looked upon in a mystical and religious sense, the spirit of the bear and man has become more of a physical and, to some degree, mental state. In today's world, the bearish man is perhaps most evident and well-organized within the bear community that exists in gay America and throughout the world. The subgroup of gay society owes its formation to several factors. The most obvious and relevant to the discussion here is the celebration of the physical attributes of these men. Clearly, qualities such as body fur, beards, masculinity, and larger frames are not typically associated with the gay mainstream, and to a large degree, are still shunned by that majority. In part, this outward rejection galvanized many gay men, causing them to form a new group consisting of men who were both appealing to and accepting of them. But to find a man as a bear was not solely dominated by the outward appearance, however. Less tangible aspects, such as friendliness, affection, and persona, also formed the idea of what it was to be a bear. Beginning as a small group, it has expanded tremendously over the past decade. With bear clubs in most major cities, thousands of members worldwide, and several magazines catering to them, bears have come into their own and now represent more than just a small outcast splinter of the gay culture. The success and popularity of the bear community, due mainly to the freedom of outwardly expressing one's masculinity, has clearly filled a void that had previously existed in the gay world. The questions then arise, what factors existed between man and bear in the past to foster such a unique relationship? And do those factors have any impact on the formation and success of the modern bear clan? Unlike any other, the association of man and bear has had a rich and long history. In the bear, we see a mirror of our animalistic side, the epitome of all that is wildness. To the Native American, this represented power, spirituality, and nature. To modern man, the freedom, strength, and playfulness are its virtues. In either case, the recognition of the animal's inherent qualities are at the core of the human-bear mythos. The purpose of this chapter, therefore, is to explore the past in an attempt to understand early humans' totemic relationship with the bear by relating their stories, myths, and legends, and in so doing, hopefully point out several of the commonalities between the past and present bear clans. Native American bear societies mainly evolved and persisted for the sole purpose of celebrating the religious significance of the animal. This totemism of the bear was so strong and so far-reaching that it has persisted throughout the greater portion of humankind's written history. The Neanderthals, living in Europe and Asia 50,000 years ago, respected the great size, strength, and power of the now extinct cave bear, Ursus speleus. These early humans formulated primitive religious practices with the cave bear at their core. The primary connection to death and renewal became evident with the unearthing of Neanderthal and cave bear bones together in caves throughout Europe. These beliefs were carried in the minds of the humans who ventured over the Ice Age land bridge that once connected Asia to North America. Taking root in what was to become the Native American population, the bear cult became truly circumpolar at this point. Also making the journey over that land bridge long before humans was the common ancestor of the varied species of bears that would come to populate the Western Hemisphere. The life ways of North America's bears and humans have been intimately linked for at least 20,000 years as both species evolved together on the continent. The native peoples that inhabited North and Eastern Siberia, Northern Japan, and North and Central America saw the same qualities in the brown, Urctus arctos, polar, Ursus maritimus, and American black, Ursus americanus, bears that were evidenced long before in the ancient cave bear. For the Native Americans, who believed all animals were sacred and possessing of individual spiritual powers, the bear held a very special place in their religious belief system. Almost every Native American culture that lived in proximity to major bear populations of North America had a commonality of customs, mythology, legends, and ceremonies involving the animal. In part, the similarity and strong presence of the bear as a powerful totem sprang from the knowledge that it was one of the few animals that could easily kill human beings. Fear-inspired respect such as this was reserved for only the strongest of spirits. This respect often manifested itself as taboos and ritualistic practices. For instance, upon slaying a bear, many northern hunting tribes would cut off the paws and poke out the eyes in order to protect themselves from the anger of the dead animal's spirit. With increased observation of the bears around them, fear slowly began to give way to the recognition of the bear's unique ability of rebirth after hibernation, its superior aptitude at locating food, and its strong maternal instincts. These characteristics were greatly revered and respected by Native Americans and elevated the bear to one of the most powerful religious symbols in many indigenous cultures. Because of these physical abilities, the Native Americans believed the bear to be something very much more than a powerful animal that conjured fear. To them, he was a brother, a kindred spirit, and a teacher. They saw in the bear an animal that had amazingly similar traits to themselves. They included physical attributes, such as the ability to walk upright for periods of time, the human-like mannerisms, as well as the striking similarity of its skinned body to that of their own. The bear was believed to be half-human, a kinsman. In fact, many tribes referred to the bear with the same term that they used for a man or relative. To the Cree of Eastern California, a bear is a furry person, a relative that goes underground when the earth sleeps and emerges when it awakes. From this respect and kinship with the animal grew a rich and elaborate system of representation. As with any totemic animal, symbology played an integral part of the ceremonies and even the daily lives of the Native Americans who cohabitated with bears. The symbolism ranged from the fetish sculptures of the Pueblo Zuni of New Mexico to the elegantly carved totem poles of Pacific Northwest tribes such as the Tlingit and Haida. The Lakota of the Northern Plains painted pictographic representations on shields carried into battle and on the teepees of their shaman. Tribes of the southeastern United States, on the other hand, performed bear dances in honor of the new year. Individuals, especially during religious and hunting ceremonies, would become bear through adornments such as bear skins and face paint. The purpose of these symbols, like those of any modern religion, was to bring the individual closer to that which he worshipped, and even more important, join the spirits of bear and human through a connection to the spirit world. To Native Americans, many animals had very strong spiritual forms and bestowed their powers at certain times to humans. For the shaman, receiving these powers through a vision was a guarantee that he would practice good medicine. Among the Northern Plains tribes, spiritual gifts came during the vision quest, a time of isolation and meditation.
Once an individual returned, he was often asked to reenact or recount the events of the quest to the elders. The visions were interpreted and the individual informed of their meaning. At this time, a medicine bundle containing various relics, sacred objects, and symbols was created and carried from that point onward. The bundle had the sole purpose of joining the owner to his spiritual guardian. In some cases, the link between the individual and his totem was so strong, as with a shaman, that it was believed he could transform himself physically into his guardian animal for the purposes of spiritual journeys and insights. Clearly, not all members of a given tribe had this level of connectedness to their spirit guide. It was only attained by a select and powerful few. Almost all individuals could, however, have a guardian spirit. Whether one's spirit was revealed through a dream or vision, as was the practice of many of the Athabascan-speaking tribes of the plains in Canada, or bestowed at birth, as was believed in Central American cultures, that guide was there for a specific reason. Exactly what that purpose was and how the person expressed his totem was, to a large extent, a function of the tribe, but also the individual's choice. The external symbols chosen had to be understood by others and typically followed long-established traditions rooted in geographical location and religious beliefs. However, the objects carried in a bare medicine bundle or displayed in a private dwelling certainly took on a more personal nature. They expressed the intimate and private relationship that existed between the guardian spirit and the individual. Totem animal spirits were always associated with certain characteristics and knowledge that was beyond the individual and therefore sought by him. Common throughout most of North America's native population, the bear, for example, was connected to the powers of healing and shamanism, rebirth and renewal from death, fighting and creation. And that was the first part of Michael S. Ramsey's chapter in The Bear Book 1, The Bear Clan, North American Totemic Mythology, Belief, and Legend.
Season's greetings. This is Ron Serratia from Bear Soup, wishing all our Bear Radio listeners a very happy Solsta Hanu Chrisma Kwanzaa Saturnalia and a delightful and safe new year. As Bear of the Year 2008, I wanted to send my best wishes to everyone who's competing in this year's poll for Bear of the Year. Freddie Freeman of Bearapalooza, Jack Sugri of Lazy Bear Fund, Joe Minetti, International Daddy Bear, Jeffrey Payne, International Mr. Leather 2009, Jack Andrew Chapman, Cubby House Podcast, Jason Lee, Mr. Australia Bear 2009, Marcus Carmichael, Dan Brother, Gavin Schiffert, Richard Francie of BearNation.us, and Keith Griffin of Cubs Out Loud. Good luck to all of you. May the best bear win. You've been listening to Bear Soup with Ron Serratia, episode number 61. Home Bears, check out the Bear Soup page on my homely little home blog, www.ronserratia.com, spelled R-O-N-S-U-R-E-S-H-A. Bear Soup is news, schmooze, skews, and interviews for the bear community. Bubbles for the Bear Soup Hot Tub are powered by our sponsor, Bare Bones Books. Please check out their fine titles by bear authors at barebonesbooks.com, spelled B-E-A-R-B-O-N-E-S-B-O-O-K-S. Look for Bear Soup also on Facebook. Please feel free to contact me at bearsoup@gmail.com. Thanks once again for tuning your furry ears here to Bear Soup.